to speak in an hour on the whole history of American Trotskyism from 1928 to 1991.
Right.
That's impossible. In fact, I don't even know if I'm going to get through with what I've outlined here, which is going to start earlier than 28, but end at 38, if I get to it. It's important for us to study and learn about this history. And all phenomenon in the universe can only be understood fully when you understand the history of that phenomenon, not just a snapshot of what it looks like at any one moment. And the phenomenon we're studying today, or partially studying today, is ourselves. Who are we? And to understand who we are, we must understand where we came from. What do we mean by Trotskyism? It has an historical definition. I'm going to quote a lot from this book, The History of American Trotskyism by James Cannon, the founding leader of the American Trotskyist movement, which covers the history up to 1938. He starts with a definition of Trotskyism. No doubt, in reading the literature of the Trotskyist movement in this country, you frequently noted the repeated statements that we have no new revelation. Trotskyism is not a new movement, a new doctrine, but the restoration, the revival of genuine Marxism as it was expounded and practiced by the Russian Revolution in the early days of the Communist International. Bolshevism itself was also a revival, a restoration of genuine Marxism after this doctrine had been corrupted by the opportunists of the Second International. So in one sense, that's our continuity. We go back to the Communist International and from that to Marx and Engels. You know, Lenin never thought he made any big advances in Marxism. There are always advances that are made. It's not a dead thing. But on the basic questions, that's what we are. So we have to look, we look to the origins of U.S. Trotskyism then in the early years of the Communist Party. Why don't we look for it earlier in the history of the very militant and fighting industrial workers of the world, or in the Socialist Party of Eugene Debs? The reason is, although both of these organizations contain many working class radicals and fighters and revolutionists, they never achieved the level of building a Marxist party in the United States. That was done by the Communist Party, the foundation of the Communist Party. That's why we look back to that point as our real foundation. It was the impact of the Russian Revolution on radicals who had developed partially under the conditions of American society that led to a split in the Socialist Party that created the first party with an internationalist program and the program of Marxism. Up until that time, very few of Marx's works even were translated into English and available in the United States outside of the economic works. With the creation of the Communist Party as a reaction to the Russian Revolution from a split in the Socialist Party, the first disciplined party, the first party that were organized on the idea of party discipline around a Marxist program was created. That was the first time that had been done. We could discuss the Socialist Labor Party and others and what kind of a person Debs was and etc. But this was a qualitative leap, in other words. It was a qualitative change that resulted from the impact of the Russian Revolution, looking at the where workers in this country began to, were inspired by the fact that for the first time, the working people, the workers and the farmers, led by the workers politically and through a working class political party, took power and held it and began a socialist transformation. Now this, actually in the beginning there were two communist parties. That shows you there was a lot of problems too. They weren't able to form such a party to get at once. And it had lots of problems. It tended to be dominated by the foreign language federations, people whose minds were more still looking back to Europe and not towards building a party based on the American workers. Cannon was a leader of this new formation and was identified with those who saw that you had to build a party based upon the American working class that knew the American working class and that you couldn't have people whose minds are really someplace else and not speaking the language of the majority of the class. He was identified with that current that wanted to do that. I won't go into all the details of how these two parties came together, but they in the first period here, they suffered severe and very sharp repression. The capitalists also had a reaction to the Russian Revolution. They got terrified. They saw they moved in and tried to crush this movement with repression. Since many of its members were foreign-born, that is, we would today, what do they call them? Illegal aliens. We say undocumented workers. Thousands were arrested, deported. A tremendous repression. This forced this new movement underground in defense. Once being underground, many of them developed there was a lot of problems of ultra-leftism in the early Communist Party. One of them was to take this necessity of being underground, which it was for a period, and make it into a virtue, and say that it's a principled question, you must be underground. That was one aspect of the ultra-leftism. Another aspect was that in their enthusiasm and their revolutionary outlook, in opposition to the old opportunism of the earlier, of the Socialist Party, they wouldn't work in the established trade union movement, the American Federation of Labor, which was a tiny section of the working class. But it was always necessary to look to the sector of the working class that is organized and to work in it. They didn't understand that. They boycotted the AFL. On elections, they were also ultra-left. We discussed that this morning on the question of different kinds of election strategy and tactics we can do. One of them is they weren't strong enough, they felt, to run in the 1920 presidential elections. Debs was running for the Socialist Party, but it didn't even occur to anyone that you could give him critical support and raise the program of the new party at the same time. This kind of ultra-leftism tended to dominate the whole of the Communist International. Often it was very new, young people that were won to the Russian Revolution, that left the opportunism of the old international, that were inspired by it. But they often had a leftist bent. How is this? The one important question of one thing that we should learn from this experience of the early Communist Party, which my thesis is that it is ours. This is our roots and where we come from. We went through this, in other words, this period of ultra-leftism, was how the leaders of the International under the Bolsheviks operated to try to correct this. I mean, some of these ideas are pretty elementary to us today, like participate in elections. We discussed all that today. You join the labor movement as it is. We don't think we're going to go out and create new unions against the existing labor movement. We don't think it's a principle to be underground. We understand how important it is to be able to have meetings like this in the open. And we want to do that if possible, and only go underground if necessary. We hope that we have the moral fiber and courage to go underground if necessary, but we don't choose it. So you might say, these are some of the ABCs. How did the Bolsheviks deal with this problem, which existed in more than just in the United States? By education, by patience. There were no administrative means to say to parties, no, you stop being underground by a vote and then make them do it, or anything like that, any kind of discipline. Or it was by persuasion. This came to a head at the Third World Congress of the Communist International, where the Bolsheviks at first were a minority on all these questions. The ultra-lefts were in a majority. And Lenin wrote something for this, a pamphlet called Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder is one of the translations of its title, which took up all these kinds of questions, this ultra-leftism. And by the end of the Congress, they had won over the Congress. And when you read that book, think of it in those terms, of its historical setting, not just as an abstract book. Lenin didn't think of, here's a brilliant idea I'll write about, because someday somebody may need this. It was always out in real struggle and real issues that were confronting the real movement at all times. So this early movement had big problems. But it also had, in spite of all those problems, which were gradually going towards being overcome, they never were completely because of the Stalinization of the Communist International. The big lesson that was taught, the big lesson learned from the creation of the Communist Party, was to take program and ideas seriously and to build a serious organization to implement them. That was new in the after some of these discussions with the Communist International, the party did come out into the open, and it began to turn to practical work in the class struggle and took its first steps in intervening in the American Federation of Labor. In fact, as Cannon points out, there was a kind of overcorrection. Bent the stick too hard the other way. Going from an ultra-left position, the early Communist Party decided that it tried to jump over objective conditions and create overnight a farmer labor party that is a broad working class formation. And there were a lot of faction fights about this. The party was plagued by a lot of factionalism. In fact, it after a while, it became crystallized into permanent faction. One of the early ones was led by William Z. Foster, a trade unionist whom the Communist Party had recruited, and Cannon, also experienced in various worker struggles. And they fought tremendous battles right up until the time when the Trotskyists were expelled. And these battles were over tactics and how to move forward, and also over power, so-called power in the organization. Those kind, who was going to be the, and that's a negative example. That's a negative lesson from this period of the formation of permanent factions, which stayed together even after the issues of which they were formed were resolved. They're no longer there, but the gang stayed together. This fact, what became a factor in when the Trotskyist movement was founded here, in that almost all of them came from Cannon's faction. See, that was a mark from that, wasn't able to reach into the other factions as easily. Now, while they were going through this and having all these internal battles, they still made progress. They put out a daily paper, which is a pretty good accomplishment if you have 10 or 15,000 members, which is what they had in the early 20s. They organized, they put on a higher plane, labor defense work than it had existed before. This is one of the things that Cannon was identified with in the international labor defense, based on the principle that an injury to one is an injury to all. All working class victims of capitalist oppression or persecution were defended. For example, the anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti from this area. One of the reasons why this factionalism developed was that none of the major leaders of the old Socialist Party came into the new Communist Party. It was really new leaders who hadn't established themselves, and the relations amongst themselves and the membership hadn't been completely decided. It wasn't as clear. Even Eugene Debs, who supported the Russian Revolution, stayed with the right-wing Socialist Party and didn't come over to build the... So there were no authoritative figures that people who, that many people had trust in and had won leadership responsibility in previously. But then something else began to happen, which became different than the early years of the Communist International. Every time there was a meeting of the Communist International, the different factions would go to Moscow to and see if they could get Moscow on their side, you know, and plead to get, and unlike the early years where they got help, political clarity, not orders or anything like that, but political clarity and help, they began to get a different kind of intervention, something that no one could understand at that time. It was as if the people in Moscow were continually trying not to solve a problem, but to stir up the factional pot and give blessing to one faction at one time, another one at another time, not to resolve the political questions. It was only later that Cannon was able to see what they were doing, was trying to push out anyone that they thought was a real independent leader. As the bureaucracy took over the Soviet Union and the Communist International became bureaucratized, the bureaucratic caste around Stalin as its major central figure began to look at the Communist International more and more not as revolutionary parties in their own countries seeking to make a revolution in their own countries, but as extensions of Soviet diplomacy. And they needed toadies. They needed people in the Communist parties who would carry out whatever they said, not independent-minded revolutionary leaders. So they blocked strong leaders. They stopped the development in the different parties of strong independent leaders who could stand on their own feet and maybe disagree with Stalin. By 1928, there were three major factions in the CP. The Cannon faction, one led by Foster, and one led by Lovestone. Now, preceding the Sixth World Congress of the Communist International, was held in 1928, there had been a big struggle against Trotskyism in the Communist International, emanating from the Russian party. Everybody had to denounce Trotsky. This was also in the American party. right before the Sixth World Congress, Trotsky and Zinoviev were expelled from the Communist International. Trotsky had already been exiled into a tiny town in the Soviet Union in the east. But at the Sixth World Congress, Cannon, who was a member of the International Executive Committee, was placed on a a commission that was supposed to review all the different programmatic documents that would be placed before the Sixth World Congress. And Trotsky appealed his expulsion, and he sent in from exile a document called the Criticism of the Draft Program of the Communist International. This Congress was supposed to take up a full program of the Communist International. And this got translated by the machinery that the Congress had set up and got into Cannon's hands. And here's where luck plays a role in history. So he read it. It's a book. We've got it maybe back there. I don't know if we have it back there. But it's a foundation book of really our movement as it comes out of the Communist Party. And its fundamental criticism was against the conception that the bureaucratic caste developed as it usurped power from the workers, and that was the idea of socialism in one country. Which really lay behind that, the idea that you could build socialism in backward Russia all by itself, even though it was surrounded by a hostile capitalist environment. And what it really boiled down to was a rejection of the road of extending the revolution, of working to extend the revolution throughout the world, which lay the basis for a policy of accommodation between the bureaucracy and the rest of the capitalist world. Now, in one sense, and there were concrete examples of how this had already played itself out in a general strike in Britain in 1926 and in the failure of the Chinese Revolution in 1927. Well, this document hit Cannon like a bolt from the blue. He said, for the first time he understood what was going on even in the American Communist Party. Why the campaigns against Trotsky? Why factionalism? Why the kind of intervention into the American Communist Party that existed before? He showed it to another person who was there from Canada, Maurice Spector, who also saw it as something that explained what was going wrong. And it explained it in a clear way, and it reaffirmed the foundations of the Communist International, of Marxism. It was a reaffirmation of the original ideas of the Russian Revolution, of world revolution. Well, three people in his faction when he got back. He didn't let anybody know when he was in Moscow that he had agreed with this document. Because he knew, he had seen other things happen. Somebody raised a difference, and they'd be kept there for 6 or 7 weeks on some task or something in Moscow, while their enemies back in the party in the United States would be organizing against them. There'd be little tricks pulled like that. So he just smuggled it out, showed it to two people who were members of his faction and workers in the International Labor Defense, Shackman and Ahern, and his companion Rose Karsner, who were convinced. So these four people set out to build a new movement. Sometimes you think we got it tough. Think back of okay, so we started out with a handful. And they went through a series of maneuvers to try to clarify their positions, and they were finally expelled as supporters of Trotsky from the Communist Party. They were ready for that too. They put out the first issue of the Militant, and which they published every 2 weeks. They had it all in print and everything. As soon as they were expelled, they had that on the street. The Militant hammered away on the questions of program, on the theoretical questions. Serialized the book, The Criticism of the Draft Program. Orienting themselves to the workers in the Communist Party, who were the most advanced workers in the country, who had come to support the idea of a proletarian revolution. And although they had been confused by what had happened to the Communist International and to the leadership of the American Communist Party, still were the people most likely to be able to understand what we were talking about and join us. Well, in the whole world, Trotsky was in exile. Many of his supporters in the Soviet Union, these are tens of thousands of people, were arrested or suppressed in other ways already. Party after party after party had denounced Trotsky on orders from Moscow. Looked like it was smashed, finished. Suddenly, from the United States came this open expression of support for the left opposition of the Communist International. It had a big impact. We later learned that news of this was printed in all the Communist parties throughout the world to denounce it, and including in Pravda. So some of the Trotskyists, you might call them, I think they call themselves left oppositionists, the Bolshevik Leninists in the prison camps in Russia, learned that in the United States there were new reinforcements from this campaign. They reacted violently. It was a massive campaign against this handful of people. One method was social ostracism. Kind of explains how powerful that can be, what a weapon it can be for somebody who gives their life to a party to then have every single friend of theirs refuse to talk to them, have their backs turned on them. And the fear of that, how that could rein you in, that was one of their weapons. The other was physical attacks to try to stop the sale of the Militant, because we were selling to Communist Party workers. And then anybody who dared look at us, or read the Militant, or who they suspected might have a friend who was, were driven out. That's how we first recruited, in part. The people driven out as Trotskyists, what is that? So we were there to explain, well, this is what it is.